Okay, we're back for episode 83, I believe.
Yes, it is, 83.
83. Well, tonight we agreed to talk about white nationalism, white nationalist, white identity. What is it? Is it a legitimate, I guess, movement or cause, or is it just part of a dialectic? Or are we people being fed into a dialectical trap by the oligarchs? Well, white nationalists. Well, I went to the Southern Poverty Law Center to see how they described it. So yeah. I kind of highlighted some points here. White nationalists. And this is what the SPLC has to say about white nationalists, about white nationalism. White nationalist groups espouse white supremacist or white separatist ideologies, often focusing on alleged inferiority of non-whites. Groups listed in a variety of other categories, Ku Klux Klan, neo-Confederate, neo-Nazi, racist, skinhead, Christian identity could also be fairly described as white nationalist. Adherents of white nationalist groups believe that white identity should be the organizing principle of the countries that make up Western civilization. White nationalists advocate for policies to reverse changing demographics and the loss of an absolute white majority, ending non-white immigration, both legal and illegal. Is an urgent priority, frequently elevated over other racist projects such as ending multiculturalism or miscegenation for white nationalists seeking to preserve white and racial hegemony. White nationalists seek to return to an America that predates the implementation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965. Both landmark pieces of legislation are cited as harbingers of white dispossession and so-called white genocide. The idea that whites in the United States are being systematically replaced and destroyed. The racist aspirations are most commonly articulated as the desire to form a white ethnostate, a calculated idiom favored by white nationalists in order to obscure the inherent violence of such a radical project. Appeals for white ethnostate are often disingenuously couched in the proclamation of love for members of their own race rather than hatred of others. In addition to their obsession with declining white birth rates, these themes compromise some of the most powerful propaganda that animates and drives white nationalist movement. Adherents frequently cite Pat Buchanan's 2001 book, Death of the West, which argues that those declining white birth rates and an immediate invasion will transform the United States into a third world nation by 2050 as the text responsible for their awakening or red pill. Although it isn't ubiquitous, there is a current anti-Semitism in modern-day white nationalist movement. Jews are common scapegoats for the perceived cultural and political grievances of white nationalists. White nationalists and anti-Semitic literature and conferences also have frequent authors and speakers. They have authors and speakers that overlap. Kevin MacDonald, author of The Culture Critique, a trilogy of books alleging a Jewish control of culture and politics with evolutionary psychology, is a frequent guest. His writing is frequently cited as as what introduces white nationalists to the idea of Jewish conspiracy. Let's see. So that's kind of how they sum it up, the Southern Poverty Law Center. I have to admit some of the points they make are accurate in the description, but again, it's what you could say. Some of it begs many questions about alleged, you know, conspiracies and what's being done. Let's see here. Yeah, most white nationalists define white people in a restricted way. In the United States, it is often, though not exclusively, implies European ancestry of non-Jewish descent. Some white nationalists draw on 19th century racial taxonomy. White nationalist Jared Taylor has argued that Jews can be considered white, although this is controversial within white nationalist circles. Many white nationalists oppose Israel and Zionism, while some, such as William Donald Johnson and Taylor, have expressed support for Israel and have drawn parallels between their ideology and Zionism. So that's kind of a summation of white nationalism. Joe, what do you have to say?
Well, it's a big topic. The Southern Poverty Law Center has, it's a very clever definition. It's actually just very active propaganda.
Yeah.
And it would be kind of interesting to know, you know, because we can't really ever know these things, but it would be interesting to know. did the author of those words, what was he sincere, or was he just a complete, you know, propagandist? Because, you know, if he was sincere, he or she was really the victim of, I guess they were a victim of their own propaganda, because it's such a, you know, they characterized it as a, you know, in a very precise and always negative way.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact is, so what they, you know, when you proposed the topic, you mentioned that there was a chance that white nationalism was, in fact, or could be, you know, a false dialectic, something that could be designed to deliberately lead Europeans into, you know, some kind of a cul-de-sac where their circumstances would get worse, you know. And I mean, the most obvious one historically was the Nazi Party, which I think can be seen as, you know, kind of actually sort of the progenitor of white nationalist parties. That's how I would look at it. But, you know, when you look even just superficially into the origins of it, you can see that it was a false dialectic, you know, that the party was established just for the purpose of actually destroying Europeans, not protecting them. So the first question I would have to, you know, people who feel that they want to enter into the white nationalist world is, what are the goals? And I think this is, you know, obviously it's a problem that hasn't been addressed very well. You know, if the goal is political, if the goal, in other words, is to get out votes to change the political landscape, white nationalism, I think, is not a good place to start. So I don't think it's a very effective political platform at the moment. I just don't think that it is too easy for the media to put the idea forward that this is coming from hatred, right? And see, this is the dividing line. This is how they can basically create the false dialectic about, you know, the white nationalist, is that they can make the case, the media you know, groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center, which I think is, it's fair to say, is basically a Jewish organization. They make the case that the desire to become, you know, part of a white nationalist movement is from hatred, right? And that the hatred is not rational. And so they make that case using the media, and I think they're pretty effective with it. I mean, if you think of, like, the white nationalists in the United States, I mean, I was talking to someone yesterday about this, because I was curious what, you know, the person on the street thought about white nationalists. And I asked them, I said, well, who do you think of as a white nationalist? This was a person at Santa Barbara Beach. And the person said, the Unabomber.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, I said, really? The Unabomber? Okay. Yeah, I said, can you, you know, articulate, like, what about old Ted was kind of racial, you know, because I think he actually was more kind of a lone wolf character than he was, you know, a proponent of, like, group identity. And she just characterized him as a white nationalist. And so I realized what I was looking at was just how effective basically the false dialectic aspect of the white nationalists. I mean, they've really had a really good propaganda run. I mean, like David Koresh, you know, they basically have this kind of quasi religious and hate filled maniac, you know, as sort of the cultural icon for white nationalism. And so I think that that's going to be hard for a lot of white, you know, nationalists who have political ambitions to overcome. And that's why I do think that even though, you know, and I'm sure we'll talk about this, there are all sorts of good reasons, and we've talked about so many of them, Tim, on the show, that there has to be a greater political organization of Europeans, right? Mm-hmm. They have to start understanding the organization and the conspiracy that they're basically up against, that is, you know, basically attempting to genocide them.
Because there are European, there's a European heritage, there's a European heritage in a tradition that needs to be acknowledged and defended against other cultures, which may not be as compatible and, dare I say, inferior to Western ideals.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can get into sort of, you know, inferior and superior concepts about, you know, the cultures, but
yeah.
I just think that there's an assault on Europeans,
mm-hmm.
and it comes from this combination of Masonic political control and elite Jewish banking and media families.
Yeah, and while America was indeed established as sort of a European outpost and developed along European lines in America, there's always a Freemasonic undercurrent to it. And in the 20th century, the American Republic was mobilized to smash traditional Europe and also break those ties with European culture that Americans had, particularly Germans and Irish and Italians and these things, and to sort of create that homogenous whiteness that they wanted at some point. Yeah.
Yeah, you've done, you and E. Michael Jones, of all of the people on the internet that I've listened to, have done the best job of explaining how before whiteness there was ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And ethnicity was a powerful force and a very powerful political force. And that was destroyed, and deliberately so. And, you do interviews with E. Michael Jones and you talk about Slaughter of the Cities, his book where he really details exactly how this was done and who did it, right? And so the creation of whiteness was something that was deliberate. It was, you know, the idea of blurring the ethnicities. And so this, right off the bat, you can see, you know, in terms of the false dialectic, that there is a problem for the European, because when you talk about whiteness, well, you've already kind of come down a rung from a point of power, because you're not talking about ethnicity any longer. Mm-hmm. You're not talking about Irish or Poles or Germans. When you talk about whiteness, you're talking about a consolation prize, basically, or consolation ethnicity, because the more powerful force, the ethnic force, is already, you're already accepting that it's disappeared, you know. Now, unfortunately, I don't see how at this point this can be avoided. There has to be, you know, if the European wants to continue to exist on the planet, there has to be some kind of organized resistance. And I don't see, at least not in the United States, any kind of ethnicity that can really organize in this way. I mean, can you think of the Irish organizing in the United States in this fashion?
No, they've been deracinated.
Right. That's how I see it. And even worse, we're already the result of so much kind of forced just voluntary miscegenation. You know, like if you look at my background, I mean, I've got like, you know, four different European groups in me.
Yeah.
And so it would be hard for me, you know, with my like 25%, you know, English, whatever it is, to like rally to some person promoting like English culture. I mean, I wouldn't know English culture if it hit me, ran over my Volkswagen. I mean, I just, what is English culture? So the thing is, it's going to be tough to try to organize. And I think that the people who are trying to organize along the idea of whiteness, they don't really have much choice, but they have to understand that it is a weakness, that there has been already a successful maneuver against us to just start out with a concept, even the term whiteness, right? Rather than, you know, the core ethnic stock that it sprang from. But in any case, the thing that will really, you know, shape the future of the white nationalists are two things. One, it's the nature of the attack. I mean, the white, to use a term, or European or Gentile, whatever you want to call them, is in the crosshairs, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, on one level you can say whiteness is just a construct, a product of social engineering, and there's not much to it. But on the other hand, you do have concepts of white privilege and race, white racism, and these are rallying cries for the left, particularly, but also for other ethnic groups, other racial groups. So if whiteness is indeed the enemy, then it must exist. But then when if people try to coalesce around that idea, then they're told it doesn't exist. So there's right. a contradiction there.
Well, but actually, it's a trick. It's just a very clever propaganda attack.
Yeah.
I mean, we're white when it suits their purpose, and we're not white when it doesn't. You know, and so that's just because we don't get to define the terms. We don't have any control over the media or the political system. I mean, there is the appearance of European control, just like in Ireland, you know, where you have this idea of a Catholic theocracy, and then you start burrowing in and you can see that the Masons and cryptos have been running the place for 100 years or more. There's really no kind of the ethnic Irish political power in Ireland. And in the United States, it's the same way. You know, you have the Bush family, the Roosevelts, you know, the Rockefellers, et cetera, et cetera. These are all Masonic families. You know, they're not white families. So it's going to be interesting to see how, you know, the idea of white nationalism, you know, how it actually goes forward. I think that, you know, trying to prepare for the show, it's such a huge topic. You know, I mean, the thing that struck me was that really it is just a wrong term, in my opinion. It doesn't work as a concept. It's too easy to denigrate. It's too easy to ridicule. And it's too easy to actually bring forward legitimate white nationalists that, you know, are hate-filled. Now, the hate may be, you know, rational, but it's easy to expose, and you know how that's going to look politically, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so I just don't see it as at this point as something that is really going to help slow down the New World Order. So
now, to take the devil's advocate approach here, because last week I interviewed Sam Dixon, who describes himself as a racial communitarian activist. And the way he described it is his plan is post-America, post-United States. He doesn't see the system as lasting too long. And this is something that would maybe come out after some sort of collapse or disintegration. He kind of identifies as a racial communitarian activist. He sees America's roots as in the British Isles, a strong tradition of individualism that came about through unique historical circumstances, and as the individual tendency of the immigrants from other parts of Europe who came to America later that led to the birth of the United States as a nation in which freedom was seen as the absolute value. He says this, I'm reading from my notes here, he says this is a mistake, an error. According to Dixon, he says the individual can only attain meaning, and this is where I agree with him, as a part of community, elevation of freedom as the absolute value that led to Americans losing their sense of connection to a specific ethnic identity. Now, that's true. I also think there's a heck of a lot of social engineering and psychological warfare going on. So that's the hidden...
We lost our sense of identity to a specific ethnic identity? Is that what he said? I misunderstood you.
Losing connection to specific Americans, no longer a connection to a specific ethnic identity that they could relate to.
We lost our ethnic identity.
Yeah.
American. Okay, I got it.
He's very critical of the idea of freedom. He says that a lot of the talk on the right is we're losing our freedom. We're losing our freedom. He says, no, we're gaining too much freedom. And I kind of agree with him because we don't hear any talk about duties and obligations, which is what you need for any society to function. And he says, although he holds freedom in high esteem is against totalitarianism, he does question view that freedom has an absolute value above all concerns. This is a problem that has developed over the course of American history. Implicit in this Declaration of Independence was this ideology of equality, which he says is mistaken. People are different. A true community, he says, cannot be established solely on the basis of freedom. He claims, therefore, America cannot be seen as an authentic nation. And I kind of agree with him there. He went on to say, conservatives are incapable of transcending the worship of freedom as an absolute value and cannot surpass the notion of America as is presently constituted. So he's thinking post. So the system is coming to a head. There's a crisis coming and some sort of plan. And the only solution, he concludes, is to realize the limitations of American conception of a nation and to work toward a new nation based on the values of community and upon a renewed connection back to our European heritage. So that being the idea, he understands that there are a lot of differences within the white communities, different ethnicities, the Irish hating the English, English hating the German. And we're at a stage now where the history is past, and there's something to a European identity that needs to be preserved, both in this continent and in the European continent. And we should put aside our differences. This is something unique to the United States because the way the United States is constituted. And that something, should there be a general crisis, this should be an organizing principle based on ethnicity, ethno-religious identity. Given the increasing division and rhetoric going out there, that maybe some sort of separation is the best way to go. And he cites, various policies. The U.S. government has consciously created an ethno-state in Kosovo, but interesting enough, opposed the creation of a Serbian Christian state, ethno-state. So certain ethno-states, when they serve a purpose, like Israel or Kosovo, they're tolerable. But then if you're a Christian ethno-state, they have to be smashed, like Wesley Clark said back in 1999 about the European ethno-states. So his point is that ethno-states do exist, and they are supported, promoted, and tolerated when it serves the interest of the great powers. And so he's sort of calling them out for their hypocrisy. They're saying some states are organized like ethno-states. In fact, recently we actually went to war illegally to create one, like in Kosovo. And he's just seeing this as sort of as this is the way to organize post-America to deal with. So that's their argument. I hope I did it justice. Yeah.
I haven't heard the interview, but I think he's an interesting person, but I think he's wrong. I think the big problem is that, he sees the kind of a chaos that is going to end up with collapse out of which, an ethnic state can emerge. Mm-hmm. I think this is a fantasy. I think that, a more informed vision of our country is that it is highly organized, highly efficient, highly malevolent, and is moving toward a conclusion that is highly predictable. So the idea that, we're entering into a chaotic, period is far-fetched. Mm-hmm. In my mind. I think it's just the opposite. We're going to be entering into the oligarch's endgame, and it's been planned. I mean, basically, look at how long the planning took, went on for like 9/11. I mean, This will probably have been in the cards for 100 years or something, and so
yeah,
I would say that all of that is good, and if he's able to use these principles in the post-apocalyptic America to organize a wholesome European community, to me this would be like the furthest thing from reality I can even imagine, but. If it happens, man, I'll be the first one to knock on the door if they'll let me in, But the fact is that he just doesn't understand how organized the oligarchs are. He doesn't understand their technology, how they're going to, bring about a technologic slave state, and the idea of them permitting, European paradise. Yeah, I think that's just about as far-fetched as anything I can possibly imagine, Tim. I think that's exactly what they want to prevent.
Yeah, I don't think you'd get a window of opportunity. Yeah,
I don't think so.
It just kind of reminds me of I was listening to an interview with E. Michael Jones on a podcast. I think it was called Gas Station Heel Turn or something, and there's a bunch of white, probably self-described white nationalists or white identitarians were hosting, and they were grilling E. Michael Jones on various topics and questions, talking about Jewish identity, Jewish power and influence, things that he's kind of an expert on. Then he started to go off on, you know, things like immigration and weaponized migration in Europe, and you know, whether how to what extent the Catholic Church is involved in promoting it, and at one level they are because they're getting money to do it, but their idea is that I got the impression when they were talking they didn't understand the full history of psychological warfare that was meant to demoralize these societies for decades, and so now they're dealing with a problem now without understanding the history of it. Good example is like what happened in Germany is the German migration crisis now. Well, you have to go back decades to what the psychological warfare that Germany was subjected to. That's what E. Michael Jones was talking about how pornography was promoted in the 70s by the U.S. State Department and the CIA in the 60s and 70s during their economic miracle. This was done to sort of demoralize and break down German society, sexualize Germany's youth and these things. At the same time, the temporal powers, so like NATO and you know the CIA and U.S. government, even the governments of you know of Germany are promoting the migration into Europe.
Promoting they are actually creating and facilitating it. You know? So they're and that's done for the purpose of genocide.
Yeah,
I actually caught I think it was an interview with you perhaps. Where E. Michael Jones was saying that there were rabbis in Germany that were taking the position that the migration was like a final solution to the German question and ethnicity. And the idea was that this would be a punishment for, kind of the racial sins that they have committed over historically. And so... that's a real good, kind of factoid, to understand these things from. And but anyway, so yeah, I just don't think that you're going to have the kind of moving forward that is, I think, possible and also ideal from kind of Dixon's perspective. I think it's. It's almost charming. It's antiquated and it just is what I would call counterfactual speculation. It just isn't. It's really not even kind of worthwhile having in one's mind in terms of how to actually make a difference. I mean the thing that we have to look at is how can we actually first of all get the people to know the truth about the nature of our political class. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we don't have that, you're just going to be basically, I think you're going to kind of be in the same boat that Dixon's in, where you can have nothing but a fantasy concept about the future. But if you, so the first thing I would say, like when you look at, the white nationalists in America, the first lesson they should have is the what forces were in back of the creation of the Nazi Party.
Yeah,
I mean if they had that awareness, then they would there would be a step to realizing that. For example, there'll be sort of violence that's in their grammar. They're kind of talking about guns and things like this. I mean, this is not moving forward. It just isn't something that's valuable. What it does is it just creates an image that is so easy for the media, which of course is Masonically controlled, then used as propaganda. What I would say is the question that I would posit to these guys is, what information is valuable to, and then how can it be disseminated? I mean, really, our position is so catastrophic at this point that the idea of white nationalism, I mean, I just don't see that as... it's not something that's really on the table as a possibility. the thing that has to happen is information. Is we have to have you know, a thousand times more Americans aware of the nature of the political class, aware of the extent of the Masonic control, and you know, and then there will be all sorts of ways that you know can the next step can come. I mean, and who knows? Maybe it would be a violent one.
Well, understanding the where we are now in America with the breakdown of the family, the sexual confusion, you know, the turmoil that people are having in their lives. And this didn't just happen. A good example is when they were talking about Germany, and E. Michael Jones brought up to these young men who didn't seem to either understand or give it much attention was the sophisticated psychological warfare. There was waged against Germany in the 60s to foment the sexual revolution, to demoralize, to cause declining birth rates, to soften Germany up to the problem it's having today. So it can be, the vacuum can be filled with weaponized migration. And so instead of going after the immediate enemy, which is the migrants, the refugees from these wars, and, you know, suffusing it with sort of, you know, I would say sort of borderline racist or hateful language, you know, identifying the real enemy in these things. Same thing happened, you know, what's happening in the United States. Integration itself, instead of saying, you know, integration was always weaponized and a lot of these Jewish groups postured to support it because one thing, they wanted to declare war in the South. We can get into why that was the case, going back to Leo Frank, the case and all that stuff. But even in the North, the breakup ethnicity, this was in league, you know, with the, at the time, the WASP establishment, and the federal government, because they wanted to weaken the Catholic neighborhoods. But at the same time, they have a deep suspicion of the Catholic Church. So they think that the church is like monolithically involved in this conspiracy. Well, it's much more complicated than that. The church itself was infiltrated by Masons and these things to corrupt it and to utilize it, you know. And so they didn't seem to understand how key it was in social engineering America in breaking up the Catholic neighbors in the North to create suburbia, to create the whiteness which they want to preserve now, you know.
Exactly. See, this is the thing, is that they're only going to misstep when they have bad information. They will just make mistake after mistake, which is all that we've ever seen come out of this force. I mean, the white nationalist basically is just a prop of the Southern Poverty Law Center at this point. I mean, they're not doing anything politically. And so you even wonder if, like, it isn't something that is deliberately created. And I think actually it probably often is. I've seen a lot of data suggesting that, you know, these kind of modern day Nazi groups are basically just false dialectics.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time, right?
Yeah. No, it wouldn't. And so that's the thing, is that, okay, so understanding the Nazi Party, I think, would be like the very first thing that these guys should be instructed in. And it's like, even like with my immigration, you know, it has obviously been weaponized. It's obviously done for the purpose of genocide. But so we want to resist this, right? We want to stop it. Well, you know, violent acts against these immigrants, is that really useful, Tim? Is that actually going to slow it down? What I think would be a more clever approach would be to try to inform the immigrants as to why they've been brought there. You see, this is whereas the battle with the immigrant would, I think, simply be a media event that the Southern Poverty Law Center would be able to have an endless loop of video they could show about the hateful essence, you know, of the white Americans.
Well, it's the same thing they did against, you know, the Southies in Boston in the 1970s, or the Polish neighborhoods in Detroit in the 1950s, or the Irish neighborhoods in Philadelphia in the 1960s and 70s. Where they were portrayed as brick throwing, you know, racist white folk when they were Irish living in their neighborhoods. They didn't really see themselves as white. They're just, this was their neighborhood and it was being destroyed. That's all they knew. They were on the ground. this idea of integration. Integration was always it was a ruse. It was a strategy there to do that. It was a, you know, that's not the key point. Is this wasn't done to improve society, integrate society. Who's to say that integration is a noble goal anyway, given that people should identify with communities and ethnicities and organize on that principle to defend their interests? I see nothing wrong with that. And there's no reason why different groups can't live peacefully among each other if they respect boundaries. And
a strong ethnicity creates families from which you have like the capacity to have basically peaceful culture, even side by side.
Well, this is the problem with the mythology of the Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Great Society, these things. These things are still sold to the American people as unalloyed good things, benevolent actions on the part of the federal government when they were not. There's a hidden grammar to all these things that people don't understand. You know, just when they're, you know, the Voting Rights Act was passed, the Fair Housing Act was passed, this is you had the federal government agent programs that are promoting black criminality with the a lot of these uplifting programs, as Martin Luther King called them, like the Economic Opportunity Office, which was funding the Blackstone Rangers, a criminal gang, to act as sort of proxies to create white flight, promoting criminal activity. The federal government, this is revealed in the 1970s. The Fair Housing Act sounds great, but that is a ruse to smash up ethnic neighborhoods, because now anyone with money can go in and break up an ethnic neighborhood, which has a right to exist. I'm sorry, you know, you could call it racism, but these are neighborhoods and these are communities. And if you respect the idea of community, you have to respect some notion of exclusivity or boundaries or the right to exclude, you know, these things. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. In fact, why isn't it a good thing? Because under the guise of integration, that is an asset that breaks down community and atomizes society, so we can all be individuals and be free. But really, if we're all individuals, we're all enslaved because we don't have the benefit of community.
100%. I wanted to circle back for 1 second to the idea of like, you know, how to basically be effective against weaponized integration. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I want to is just because I think it's just sort of an easy to understand example of the point I'm trying to get across, which is that direct confrontation, the kind of confrontation that the media loves, right?
Yeah.
Has not been very effective at slowing down the immigrants. You may notice there's a lot of immigrants, right? So it hasn't really worked. Now, So maybe another approach might be considered, and what I'm suggesting is that the thing that is possible on a mass scale to accomplish, perhaps, is information to the immigrants. In other words, has anyone bothered to look at informing the Middle Easterners who are being, you know, foisted into Europe as to why they've been brought here and who is bringing them? See, this is why I think that this is where there could be an opportunity. Now, I can't guarantee how this would work out. I can only say that, you know, in a fantasy scenario, you could get to the Northern African immigrant communities and say, look, you've been brought here for one purpose only, and that is to destroy white culture, our European culture. You're here to basically, because the people who did this think you are a debased culture. They think you are something that will diminish the Europeans who you will be interbreeding with. Well, I think that can be documented and shown, and then you have to wonder, well, how would the immigrant community relate to that information? Because, see, what I think from what I can and what I'm able to gather is that their idea of why they've been brought there is heroic. They think they've been brought there because, you know, the Europeans created a lot of war and now we're suffering from it. There was colonialism.
Yeah.
And this is kind of like a way to like morally balance that equation. Right. Now, if you told them the truth about, well, no, actually, that's not why the Masonic, you know, Angela Merkel, who is 100% satanic, brought you here. She doesn't operate like that. She doesn't have those kinds of altruistic ideas. You are basically a a human like cult piece of culture in a petri dish. You know, it's just something that she's doing in an experiment, or hardly experiment, just as a way to basically to create a culture that is easy to enslave and control. And you're not being brought here for freedom, just the opposite. You're being ultimately brought here to be part of a slave class. Now, okay, long-winded, sorry, but I'm just saying is that that is something that we can do. It's something that is true, right? Something that is real. And it's something that the research community, the thing which is developing from the internet, could really take the lead in getting the data, in interacting with internet leaders of the immigrant community, and then saying, look, you know, before you go out into the streets, after you've been basically set up to rape people and to feel justified doing it, how about looking at another aspect of why you've been brought here and who brought you here and what is the purpose of you being here? You know, so that's why, you know, when you look at like the stuff that E. Michael Jones did with Slaughter of the City, I think that kind of documentation was great. It just came out, you know, 40 years too late, right? It didn't have an effect, Tim, because to stop any of this, because it just came out too late. But what if it had come out, you know, in the early 60s? There's a chance that there could have been an organized resistance. And so this is what I'm saying, is that when you go to the white nationalists and you create the kind of martial dialectic, you got to look at these kids and you're, you know, my heart goes out to them. I can see where these feelings come from. They are being slaughtered. They know it. They can, you know, sometimes they can't articulate it, but they, you know, they know they are. They know there's something wrong with, you know, with the Southern Poverty Law Center and the verbiage. You know, they know that they're being lied to. They know that there's a, you know, but they don't know how to respond. And the response that to organize into, you know, like a white nationalist organization, and think that that's going to have some have some effect of what to what they would like to see, I just think it's far-fetched, Tim. I think that they have to think better, think more dialectically, and try to come up with something that'll actually resist the nature of the attack they're being subjected to.
Now, I do think there is a legitimate concern about demographics, and I'm going to say this. I'm going to say that an America that is less than 50% European will lose all connection it has to, you know, to its Republican constitutional principles. It'll be a different, completely different country culturally and therefore politically, and that's the goal, and that's the stated goal. And they admit this, the people who are promoting, you know, mass immigration. It's very hard to have a conversation, you know, with a mob, and that's, they're overwhelming the system with these immigrants. This also, in conjunction, you know, with a very generous welfare state, makes for a very toxic, you know, cocktail. At the same time, you have, you know, it's obvious. You have, I mean, your federal government working with NGOs that are funded from various Jewish organizations that are facilitating the transportation of hundreds of thousands of refugees or migrants, you know, from North Africa, the Middle East, into countries like Sweden, you know, or Germany, or even Minnesota, or Vermont or something. And this is their idea of, you know, of experimenting, of moving populations around, you know. We talk about the changing demographics, the changing complexion of America. That's been talked about for a bit over 20 years as the gradual decline in the white population. One time it was well over 90%, now it's around 70%. And trends continue, it would be less than 50% by the latter half of the 21st century. And what will that, what does that portend politically and culturally? I've cited this before. There's an article by UCLA law professor Adam Winkler a few years back. I forget which election it was. Might have been the 2014 election. And he was talking about gun control as an issue and the power of the National Rifle Association. And pretty much the article was, you know, the NRA won today, but they're not going to win in the long term because of demographics, because of the browning of America, as he said. As America becomes less white, there will be less support for the Second Amendment in the Constitution. And so, therefore, the governments will be free to violate it, if not repeal it. Well, if that is indeed true, that these demographics will result in a qualitative shift in American politics, then Americans who are concerned about defending such rights like the Second Amendment have a legitimate grievance there and have a legitimate objective in reversing those demographics. Therefore, policies have to be implemented, such as ending legal and illegal immigration, promoting birth rates among the European population in the country. And this would require a consciousness of European Americans, Americans of European descent, white Americans, to do these things. They're kind of gaslighting us with this. They're saying, you know, you can't be concerned about demographics because you're a racist, but they're citing demographics as saying, oh boy, you know, the future belongs to us because, you know, America's going to be more racially diverse in the future, and therefore we won't what remains of the Constitution, there won't be much political support for it.
And you can just be sure, Tim, that guys like Winkler are going to say, you know, we're just going to turn over the foreign policy and the Federal Reserve to the, you know, welcome Latin Americans.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, see, this is the thing. It's just, it's ludicrous. Mm-hmm. It's a, you know, it's just weaponized. It's a sophistry, you know, basically. The guy's just lying and he's just trying to fool people.
Yeah.
And what he knows perfectly well why they want a very ethnically mixed America is because it's the easiest slave state for them to rule over.
Yeah,
it's as simple as that. I mean, it's just in fact, the idea that isn't what's going on is completely ridiculous. So the thing is, and I would just try to go back to the point I was making before is that if you look at this problem, if you look at basically contesting Winkler, trying to, how do you basically, get more children that are European? How do you get the Europeans to resist the sexual debasement and pornography, right, that is all around them? How do you get them to resist, the propaganda of the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Holocaust narrative, things like this? Well, the only way, the way that can be done is through information. We need a revolution of information. This is why, the universities are such a pivot point for the oligarchs and why they try to control them and why the internet is such a great hope for those of us who are being genocided in that this is the revolution of information exchange. This is what we are about, Tim. This is why this show exists. It's why the media, the internet media, is such a threat to the oligarchs. Is that what we need to do is to get 150 million Europeans to be on the same page with Tim and Joe. That's what we need. Where they can understand these concepts, where they are not intimidated to the point where they are unable to talk about them. Because a lot of this stuff is so obvious, right? Like Winkler's, argument or the Southern Poverty Law guys, propaganda, that if the Europeans had a sense of being attacked, if they had, like I was going back to E. Michael Jones' information about how the ethnicities were attacked in the 60s, if the ethnicities had that information at that point, they might have been able to resist. And in our current situation, the Europeans are being genocided on a number of fronts. You know, you've got the chemicals, you've got the sexual degeneracy, you've got the immigration. You have all of the psychologically debasing historical narratives.
Well, that's what's when I read that, read the beginning, I read the Southern Poverty Law Center critique of white nationalists.
Yeah.
How they talk about this notion of white genocide and declining birth rates. all these policies have been promoted that bring about such a thing like lower birth rates. This is done through indirectly through pornography, sexual revolution, you know, these things. This results in lower birth rates. This results, and but they'll talk about these as if this is a fan, but they're admitting that these things exist. Why do we have these demographic trends? Well, because you had these cultural trends or the psychological warfare, the program that's carried out through the American Jewish Committee and MK Ultra in the 50s and 60s, you know, the authoritarian personality. So the literature is there that the war was declared. Yeah. You know,
and it's declared and it's being waged. And yeah. You see, this is the thing, is that we have no awareness as a people of the attack in general. We are just blind to it. We are being stabbed in the back.
Well, that was funny. I was listening to an E. Michael Jones on that interview. He made some connection. What was it? He said his interlocutors or his people interviewing didn't seem to have any really appreciation of the authoritarian personality and the importance of the crack up of the ethnic neighborhoods in the 60s, in the 50s and 60s. And one even laughed at him when he suggested this was an objective, betraying his ignorance of the matter. Again, they're going after the immediate problem without understanding the long history of this. And if you don't understand the history of this stuff, you really don't understand what's happening to you. You know, so.
Absolutely. See, I don't – this is the thing. I don't think – I mean, this is why, you know, a real primer of our history, you know, from, I mean, we could start at many point, but you could start from like Gregor Lukacs and the Hungarian Soviet, right. And then into, you know, the Frankfurt School, into cultural Marxism, into the slaughter of the cities, you know, into the Holocaust narrative, into this, the whole way that the attack has been waged and into the science of propaganda.
Yeah, psychology, and then, psychiatry. Yeah.
Yeah, and then have that book as, you know, mandatory reading. Well, you could actually start having some interesting changes because, you see, we really do need to turn around the birth rate for a number of reasons. I mean, one of them because we don't want to go out of existence.
Yeah.
But it's where from the European was led into the abyss by a number of cultural forces. And one of them was they were blending us with the African-American communities that were, since they were the most vulnerable, had been the most debased. Right. They were going to integrate, but it wasn't going to be some kind of integration with the idea of creating wholesome culture. It was an integration with the idea of debasement. And that's why they really went after the inner city with the welfare programs to make sure the family would just be wiped out, because they've had this idea of blending the races for hundreds of years. Right. So they wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to blend into something that had any strength. So this, because we were basically pulled down, I would like to hope that the European could also lift up, right, that by returning to the principles, you know, of family and of ethnic solidarity, that we could reverse by being an inspiration to the cultures that have been debased, and particularly the African American, you know, because I think that was the culture that was most damaged by these guys, most viciously attacked. And so they are now, you know, they're sort of like the African American communities in many ways, to my mind, are akin to the immigrants, where they see their debasement as kind of a heroic rebellion. You know, this is the pimp life, the drug salesman, all of these things are kind of caricatures.
But yeah, and hating whitey. So.
And hating whitey, right? Yeah. And then feeling that, you know, getting by, but just by not trying to basically use education and technology as a way to better their lives, but rather seeing these other alternatives, this has all been force-fed to them, right? So anyway, if the... if the information revolution can inspire, you know, a generation of Europeans, and not just here, but in Europe, that we should really recognize the attack, talk about the attack, understand the attack, and then start reversing the most vicious effects. In other words, particularly birth rate, sexual degeneracy.
Oh, then you have to fight like things like pornography, which has become normalized.
Of course.
But and how you do that is effectively is let people, again, if they lived in communities that were based on an ethno-religious makeup, organizing principle, that community could defend against such things, which is why they were destroyed back in the 50s and 60s. I've seen this occur in a microcosm, just in a small community where everyone happens to be, you know, Catholic, and about, you know, 20, 30 families, and they're all kind of the same. They all know each other, and they kind of take care of one another, look out for one another, and it's almost done unconsciously or subconsciously, whatever, but just done. And because of this, they're, to a certain extent, they're able to kind of take care of their own affairs. And you can extrapolate from that, you know, the same way, you know, it's just one of these things where if you subtract or take social engineering and psychological warfare out of the equation, a lot of these problems that America was facing could have been resolved much more peacefully and equitably. It just wouldn't have been along the lines of the social engineers, the integrationists, and the planners and these things. Where who's to see, people say, do you support segregation? Do you support integration? Who's to say one's over better than the other? It depends.
Support weaponized integration for the purpose of debasement.
Yeah, for the
purpose. They cleverly use these titles and terms and things, but they would do so in a way to, like, distract people from thinking about the truth, which is that there has been weaponization. They use these things to destroy. They're not trying to help the North African immigrants when they insert them into Africa. These guys are the same group that, like, benefited from slavery. This is done as a kind of final solution for the Europeans. That's what they're doing it for. Mm-hmm. So if the resulting culture is not going, believe me, they are not going to say, gee, now that you're here, we're going to give you the controls of the EU banking system. Yeah, I don't think so. I think what they're going to do is going to go, look, you're slaves. You're sex slaves. You're basically menial workers. And we're basically going to get rid of you with robots in a generation or two anyway. That's your future. And that's why we brought you here.
Yeah.
You see? So again, this is information. It's data, and this is what the Europeans in America should have an understanding of. This is what the Europeans in Europe should have, and this is the information that we should be exchanging with those ethnicities that we are being we are being attacked with. We shouldn't go. I mean, the idea of like, I think Dixon's, you know, the stuff Dixon's talking about. Hey, you know. It's a charming idea, but I don't really see how to get there without a whole lot of information.
Well, in his defense, he did also go on, I wouldn't call it a rant, but he went the list of horribles with the crimes of American foreign policy that bring about these problems, like in destroying the Christian communities in Syria and in Iraq, and how no Christians in America who rally behind the war state, particularly evangelicals, pointing that out. And same way that, you know, the Pope will talk about the need for Christians to be charitable in Germany to receive these refugees or migrants, but he's silent about the wars in these areas.
Yeah, isn't that a little odd?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, just again, this goes back to just information. I mean, the fact is that the Masonic crypto-Masonic Jewish project of like political domination has always had as goal, certainly the papacy would have been goal number one.
Yeah.
Because at that time when the project got started, the Pope was the political force that they most both hated. And also if they could get at that point of leverage, they could have just enormous control over Europe. And then, of course, from there, you have the banking and the political class as well. These things have long since succumbed. they have been successful. They have taken over these political structures. So that's information that, if it is widely disseminated, can bring more effective resistance.
One thing I do find interesting is that the ability of the ruling class, of the secret societies, of the oligarchs, to, well, almost, they're able to improvise at times, too, when they can use the victims of a previous crisis they fermented to carry out to achieve a future or objective. A good example is the integration of in the 1940s and 50s, when it actually began during World War One. But you had a lot of surplus labor in the South, brought about from the poor economic conditions in the South. So you had these sharecroppers from the Mississippi Delta, South Carolina, that could be shipped up into the North to work in the war factories. So this was used to not only provide the labor for war production, but also to weaken the power of the Northern labor unions that were negotiating, you know, with big business. At the same time, you could also use it to smash up, you know, destroy these, integrate these neighborhoods and create suburbia and these things. But that these conditions were created, of course, in the South by the North. The North not only did invade and crush the South and destroy its economy and loot it for 12 years and got out, and then you had the, you know, post-Reconstruction period and these things. But after that, they imposed regulations economically on the South, such as discriminatory railroad rates, which kept it from industrializing, to keep the people poor so they could get the resources cheap, both the resources and the labor, and use it later on. And this is something that they do, you know, that apparently that's something that's been, it's occurring in Latin America too, with, you know, decades and decades of destabilization, whether it's Guatemala, whether it's El Salvador, Nicaragua, Mexico, these things. The crimes of the empire come home to roost at home. And now we have, good example, NAFTA in the early 1990s just destabilized Mexican agriculture. So you have this great migration north in the United States to, and there's always industry here that wants cheap labor. And problem is, without, you have Americans, certain, whether it's business interest or Americans who just want to have, pay lower rates for landscaping or house painting or labor, but they're willing to save a few bucks to totally disrupt their communities. Because Americans have no community. They have no identity. There's no American identity. This is the problem of America itself. It's simply too big. So it's open.
But also, Tim, just remember, because I, in California, we really experienced that phenomenon.
Yeah.
Where the Latinos became the, you know, at first they were like just menial laborers, but now, believe me, I mean, if they were subtracted, the whole place would just seize up and blow away, you know. And so, but why that happened was, you know, weaponized integration. But what was the, you know, the kind of the alchemical element that brought this about? Whereas no white kids. I mean, there was no working class white children coming forward from the baby boomers. When I went to my 20th high school reunion, I went to Pacific Palisades High School. It's upper middle class kind of beach community. There was like 1,600 people maybe at the school. So figure, you know, like, oh, I think there was more, maybe like five, maybe, yes, more, no, it was more than two. Anyway, there was like, say, 500-600 kids in my class. At the 20th high school reunion, I think, you know, they listed the kids that had been born from it. There was like 25 children.
Jeez.
I mean, it was an absolute wipeout. And so this had taken place, and the kids who had done the jobs that I did.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a box boy, you know, I worked as, you know, different kind of odd jobs. I mean, I actually worked one summer as a cable splicer for General Telephone Company, you know, and so they weren't there. And so now when the migrant shows up, there's this desperate need for labor. And so you can see how, you know, everything has been organized in advance to create the basically, you know, to start deracinating the culture so that the European culture, which is dominant, will start to erode. Has no children, of course, so it's mechanically eroding. But also, it doesn't have the basically, it doesn't have the workforce to be the dominant, economic force any longer.
Yeah, this is funny how the moral and the cultural affects the economic in less than a generation.
Yeah, I mean, if you go to like Apple, Facebook, and Google, and watch the people come out, and I have friends in these institutions, so I've been there, and there are very few Europeans. You know who there are? Just 1,000 of is Indians from India.
Yeah.
They have just an enormous, I mean, across the street from Apple's Cupertino is like 5 restaurants are all Indian, you know, because that's just who works there. So the European has basically been evaporated or is in the process of being evaporated. Anyway, grim stuff, but how to reverse it? Well, white nationalism, Tim, I think that there are principles which are, come from the right place in the heart, for sure. But what there isn't is strategy. And the strategy in my mind, man, if you can, there is no strategy that can possibly work that isn't started with enormous groundswell of information exchange. Mm-hmm. This is where we're at, brother. I mean, we all of us have this responsibility. Said over and over again, don't be intimidated. Bring up the tough subjects. Have your facts straight. And start when you can find someone who is in the capable, who has like you can communicate with, has grasps these things. See if you can find another one, become a book society or something. And what I've been saying is go down to the farmers markets, public places that you can have 4 or 5 of you who are well versed in the data and talk about 911. I mean, there's a way to do information exchange. Talk about weaponized feminism.
Well, how many of these, as Michael Jones calls them, 20-year-old white guys? There is a benefit to getting older, is you can cite foolishness faster. Right? I mean, it's one of these things. Is how many of them have children? And you cite the absence of children, and that's the big thing. If you have no children, then the vacuum is going to be filled by somebody, and so that's the first thing. But in order to create that culture of family, you have to create the values that promote family growth, and that is, as you have to do with your culture of pornography, reintroduce sexual morality, chastity, reverse the sexual revolution, reverse feminism. These are all cultural issues. I think that precede any real political platform in this. In fact, it almost like you don't even need a conscientious political platform if you do these other things, because the politics just rolls from it naturally, develops from it naturally. I had a discussion with E. Michael Jones, it was maybe a couple of years ago. I had finished his book, Barren Metal. We were talking about his book, and in part of the book he talks about, there's a moral way, there's a moral economy and an immoral economy. And there's economic activity isn't all neutral. There's sustainable moral economic activity, and there's also unsustainable immoral economic activity. He was talking about the spending patterns and habits and living patterns of Americans in the 1970s and 80s with the introduction of the birth control pill. And these things were American, and this with the pill, well, with the woman womb medicated and rendered barren chemically. It was only right for her to go out and start earning a living too. Why should the man, if she's not providing for children, she should work too? This produces the dual income, and so there's a immediate income boost for couples. And this changing spending patterns, instead of diapers and saving for tuition and these things, and spending for children, you're buying a Harley Davidson or perhaps a boat. Or you're speculating, you're paying more for real estate. So this is driving up the real estate value. This is penalizing those families that are more traditional. It makes it less sustainable and makes it less practical, therefore less frequent and rare. So you have a cultural decline. You have a boost in consumerism and a decline in in equity and savings and a lower birth rate, and you get the economy we have today, which is emptied out, which is the problem you cited with your graduating class having very few children and grandchildren, and you have the vacuum, and it's filled in by these migrants that are shipped in to exploit the cheap labor because, you know, this goes up. But you know, this could be reversed if perhaps there was sort of a general strike, a consciousness, and this is good, you're arguing about information, is what if women were conscientious of the fact that they're they're being screwed in the workplace, meaning by having to go in the workplace to begin with, and that they should be at, they shouldn't abandon their looms. They should have children, take care of the children. And if they left the workforce, this would increase wages. This would increase their wages so the men could support them and they could get back to a more sustainable situation. But this goes against the whole zeitgeist of the last 60 years when we're talking about women's liberation, opportunity, and consumerism. That's what we're up against.
Yeah.
Because I sound like a, like a Neanderthal when I say that, but look around you. Are you impressed with the results?
Well, yeah.
I mean, come on.
Yeah, of course. And the thing is, though, is how can the truth be basically presented? You know, yeah. that, and so it is the when you start trying to get people to understand, you know, the elements of the culture, say in the 50s, that we should basically head toward, right, try to reverse some of the, I think that they won't understand it. They will resist, and to the same extent that people will look at white nationalists as coming from, you know, a perspective of hate, there has to be an information exchange that occurs even before these concepts are given to them, where you explain the attack. If they can, you know, it's hard to know how to do it. I'm not, you know, good at it. I just know that it has to be, if you come up to a woman who's working and
I know,
start explaining these things to her, it's going, man, I'm telling you, it's very, very difficult. I mean, I can't imagine many minds facile enough to be able to, you know, not immediately, you know, have kind of defenses and intellectual structures that are real, you know, that they will respond with, rather than, you know, trying to see your point.
Yeah.
So the idea is well, we have to, I think that the concept that can get through is there's been an attack,
mm-hmm.
and it was done without, we didn't know what was going on, obviously, because it was kind of a propaganda mental attack, but there was an attack. There was a group that took over the political system. They studied us. They learned how to manipulate us. We are being manipulated, and we are headed for extinction. I think if they get that, then they, like this hypothetical woman we were talking about, would, I think, have a more open mind to the next steps as to, well, how can we resist? Because she has to first realize that there is an attack that should be resisted. You know, like it's sort of like the sperm count,
mm-hmm.
the pathetic sperm count that we have, the Europeans are currently, you know, suffering from. Yeah, I mean, you have to show that this is something that came about from an attack. This isn't just history unfolding. It isn't just the effects of technology. This is an attack. Then people will do something about it. Then someone, a male, might say, you know, I'm going to like change my diet. I'm going to look at my sperm count as something that is sacred and something that's to, you know, basically a part of my future. And so I'm going to take care of it. Our personalities have been made insipid, where we don't have that kind of sense of heroism of like, you know, here, kind of ironic talking about sperm, but the idea that, you know, you're a component of a process, right? That, you know, there is things you should be thinking. If you're healthy, you'll be able to sacrifice because there are things that are noble, and the your personality will be strong enough to say, you know, this is something that I'm willing to suffer for.
Yeah.
The you know, the pornographic male, he can't suffer for anything. I mean, his sense of heroism is non-existent because he doesn't have the psychological strength and the physiological strength, you know, to be able to muster, you know, what is basically self-sustaining heroism. You know,
now in their defense, and not just the white national, they're looking at a disastrous 60 years of social engineering.
Sure,
and, you don't have to be a white, conscious white nationalist to be disturbed by this. The integration of schools was a disaster. Schools are worse for it. The blacks, using schools for blacks, for the black students were worse. It's been a disaster for the black family. And beyond, out of that, it's been disastrous culturally for America, because a lot of the integration talk also coincided with the promotion of degenerate behavior. You know, the guys of popular culture or just, integrating in these things. We had a show about race mixing a while back that said this coincides with the promotion of degenerate behavior, and it shows in the figures. When 90% of white women who have children with black men never get married, and 85% of them are on welfare, that is a disaster. That's a disaster, you know.
Thing is, it's a disaster, Tim, but it's also a triumph, because remember, this is weaponized.
Yes.
So when we talk and you have the grammar of disaster, we're talking from the perspective of the basically being defeated. I think it's better information exchange to point out that this is a tremendous success.
But on their own terms, by their own stated terms, they have failed as advertised.
I mean, they have succeeded in partially destroying us.
My point is, they should rhetorically be on the defensive for the disaster they have wrought with their social engineering, with their forced integration and destruction of the
Southern Poverty Law Center. Yes. Should not be able to sit there with their little schmarmy sophistry
and work with the FBI
and get away with that crap. I mean,
work with Google to shut people down on YouTube.
Yeah,
you know,
right. So the thing is, why
they sit on $100 million endowment.
You know? Yeah, real heroes. Well, you know, look, we've been attacked. The white nationalists are, people who are responding to it. So they're to be, they're at least they should be given accolades for the fact that they are reacting, as opposed to people who just sit there and take it. But it's obviously, as it was in the proto white nationalism, the Nazi Party. There are ways to respond to the attack that are effective, and ways that are simply going to make the effects of the attack worse.
Yeah.
And we have to, be smart enough and analytic enough to look at the attack and try to come up with ways to that are actually effective to resist it.
E. Michael Jones has a grid. He says it's like charging machine gun positions with spears. Good example he cites was Charlottesville, where, these guys had a permit to protest the taking down of the Confederate statues, and the carpetbagger government there kind of with the police set up a trap for them, where they suspended the event, and then they didn't protect the people who had a permit from the Antifa counter protesters, which from all accounts instigated the violence. But he says, well, it's naive. He says it's kind of like back in the 80s and 90s, you had Operation Rescue, who were opposing abortion and thought they could utilize the strategy of the civil rights movement to get to gain political traction and get media sympathy and support. Where it turns out that the system, the oligarchs, did not want to see, they wanted to promote abortion, so they weren't given the same privileges as the civil rights movement, because the civil rights movement was promoted for a certain reason. Same thing with these guys protesting. They're naive enough to think that we have rule of law and protection.
Exactly.
They don't. They
also
don't.
There's an impartial media.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the thing. This is why the white nationalists are just, they're just too naive to be effective. Mm-hmm. What we need is an information revolution and a revolution in thinking skills, because another thing that we've been, obviously damaged by and damaged,
a cultural counter-revolution.
A cultural counter-revolution, yeah. Exactly. And a cultural counter-revolution, all you have to do is just look at what they have done. Look at the reduced sperm count, the ending of families, the women in the workplace, the self-esteem, the guilt over the whole. I mean, just look at every single element that has been pounded into us since the World War II, and say these are the areas where we're going to begin our resistance. is we're going to unravel all this nonsense and expose these things as propaganda. This is what we got to do.
And war is declared before Hitler. Freud and Lukacs predate Hitler, and so does the Wilhelm Reich.
Exactly.
So don't give me, you know, this authoritarian personality stuff. We're doing it because, you know, because of Hitler. No.
Go Google The Tempest and Atwell, and you'll see my analysis of that play, and you can see just how old this attack is. So the Brave New World is something that was envisioned long ago. They are very clever, very well organized, and but at the same time, they are human, and if we are thinking well, believe me, the propaganda, it will have no effect on us, and what to do next would be self-evident, Tim. Yeah. We'll know what to do.
Well, you know, it's okay to be white. Can I say
that? It's okay, man. Okay, bro. Just don't be a white pornographic male.
Yeah, that's.
That's not okay. Yeah, I mean, so you know, it's information revolution. All props to the white nationalists to have some guts, but we have to criticize them for strategies that are just doomed to failure. We really need to be more clever. We need to think better. We need to come up with. I gave some ideas. I mean, these could not, maybe not the best ideas, but they are at least, I'm trying to give examples of how we can, like, basically kind of use a cultural and intellectual jujitsu, use their force against them. If they bring the immigrants in and we can't stop them, because how do we, you know, the political class is completely compromised. You know, Merkel was talking the other day about, you know, the end of national sovereignty. I mean, she's just a 100% satanic.
Yeah.
Masonic cesspool.
None of them have children, from what I understand.
Of course. Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, if, at least not with. I won't make jokes here. But anyway, so the thing is, okay. So you can't stop them. Well, are you able? A lot of the immigrants are actually highly intelligent. Can they be reasoned with? You know, because if the immigrants start saying, you know, we realize why we were brought here. We've done the research, and we see we were brought here to basically merge with the European to set up a slave state, which will basically be replaced by robots in one generation. And you know what? We're not going to have any of that. You know, imagine that. Imagine that story circulating, you know. So
well, if we have robots, won't we be all like George Jetson or something?
yeah. Well, at first we got to. Yeah. Well, I mean, here I am with a self-driving car, so I can't really make too many jokes about that.
Well, they'll lure you in with a sex robot.
You know? Yeah, that's right.
You know, that's right. So
hey, I'm too old, but I'm a high sperm guy, so who knows? All right, brother.
Okay, Joe. Have a nice weekend. Happy New Year.
Well, you too. Happy New Year. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Bye.